Good evening. James McCanny here with my Science Hour. It is May 28th, 2015. We're almost done with May. I can't believe this year is flying by already. Tonight's main science topic, I will be talking about the more human side of natural disasters of the celestial type. Let's take a specific example, and we actually have a lot of data on this. If you look for it, and some people have studied it, some people deny it. There's a lot of people that deny this. But that's what Velikovsky said. He said the human race is in a state of mass denial. And by the way, if you hear a little noise in the background, I've got some kind of a construction activity going around me here, and that you might hear a little bit of noise. But at any rate, what happens to the people? What kind of human effects the general population, etc.? What happens after a serious, literally mass extinction? That'll be my science topic tonight, and then relating it to the natural disasters. And remember that I have a two CD set entitled The Physics of Ancient Celestial Disasters. It is 18 hours of lectures and an interview, for example, with Warner Sizemore, the personal assistant to Velikovsky. Very interesting interview. But at any rate, the talk tonight, I want to concentrate on the human side of those natural disasters. Remember that the Noah event, the Noah's flood, was a separate event thousands of years before the Venus-Moses event, and this tremendous effect on the population at that time, something that's completely bypassed, ignored, and denied by modern science, archaeology, anthropology, etc. I just saw an article this week trying to extend man's population or family off to another kind of side race off in Mesopotamia with a find of about 3.5 million years ago, allegedly. And so anyway, they're still trying to put that origin of man back at that time. Really, really some very loose connections there. But as long as they can say that the Earth did all of this by itself, then they're good to go, and nobody can question them. As long as they have the power, they're publishing in, for example, Nature magazine. This is that closed loop academia. They're out in the field, the archaeologists, anthropologists, and they're all, it's like a big clubhouse. But there's no ability for anybody else to get a word in sideways. But first, a few announcements. This past week, I did not get many updates on my webpage, so I apologize for that, but actually there's a tremendous amount of reading there. I suspect that very few people have covered everything that's there, especially with the more recent postings on the picture of the day, those subpages. So scour around the webpage. There's a lot to read there. Just a brief notice on my new release. I announced about a week ago that I have a new release coming out, and I have somewhat postponed that because there's just a lot of material to organize and boil down. It's just exactly what do I present to the public. This past week, I ended the end of the world sale. I kept it up there for about a week. It was very successful. But what it tells me is that, interesting what people were buying, a lot of the things they bought were not on sale. But a lot of people also took advantage of those great prices on the 10 packs, the stainless steel water filters, etc., that had really unbelievably low prices. I raised the prices somewhat. I had to get them back up to normal. I'll probably raise them a little bit more in the very near future. But the end result is that people are just out of money. They need these products. I talked to some other people, I won't say who, but big name people in the preparedness industry, and they have all put major sales up and gotten good responses from people. What does that tell you? People need things, but they can't afford the full pricing. And so the only way to deal with this is to just, bring prices down and, on my end, tighten my belt too. Everybody's got to tighten their belt, and so that includes me. But go to the webpage, jmccsci.com, go to the sales page. Still really super good pricing, although I don't think we'll ever see the end of the world sale pricing ever again. But still good pricing there. And remember that my GF filters do not need add-on filters. It's the only filter on the market that you don't have to buy an add-on to take out the fluoride, the arsenic, which is in most water. Most water has arsenic in it, whether it comes from your own well, whether it's city water, etc. Just a comical note here. I see that California recently is using sewage. They're going to be drinking sewage out in good old L.A. there. Hate to say it, boys and girls who live on that end of the world, but wow. But if I were anybody in L.A., I'd be buying one of my water filters and at least have a final filter at the end of the line there. But I believe that all of this is contrived. I believe that this is a contrived situation. People have asked me to comment about the flooding in Texas. I know that the people living there believe that they are under attack. The 10 bikers that were shot in the head there, this is clearly a pre-Jade Helm operation to soften the public. As I call it, weather bombing. It's a term I coined a very long time ago. I'm probably one of the pioneers that started back in the mid-90s talking about weather control. I actually had some developments with the Russian scientists I was working with. Much of this work absconded with by the insane people that are running the U.S. military these days. The Russians actually went to the U.N., asked them to create a law, international law, against weather bombing, use of weather as a military weapon. The UN wrote up a thing, but the United States would not sign it. The United States signed kind of a lesser, we'll think about it type of thing. But the reason they wouldn't sign it is because you couldn't do it against your own population. You couldn't use weather control, weather manipulation, or weather bombing, as my term, against your own population, and that's why the United States would not sign that. John Nash, mathematician, the subject of the movie A Beautiful Mind with Russell Crowe, died this past week in a car crash. Now, this is, to me, a very strange situation, and I don't want to play the conspiracy Trump card here, but I can tell you something. This is one guy on the planet who had the ability to understand my prime number work. The details of the accident, it almost sounded like what happened to Gene Schumacher, where I never believed that Schumacher died in the accident in the Australia. I followed that from the very beginning, and the stories, there were three different stories that came out. The first two didn't add up at all. The first one was that he rolled his Jeep down in that crater that he was studying over there and died. And like, wait a minute, Gene Schumacher, a guy that's been in this crater, rolls his Jeep and seriously injures his wife who's with him, and and he dies in this accident. The second story that came out was that he was turning... the first story was so absurdly ridiculous that they had to come out with a second story. The second story was that he was up, turning onto the main road, coming out of the crater, up on the main, if you call it a highway. This is out in the middle of nowhere in the Australian outback. So it's not like a major travel thoroughfare. And the second story was that one of these big double-length tank oil trucks was coming across the outback, and as he pulled onto the highway, it hit him and killed him. That was the second story. Well, in the outback, it's dry. You can see the dust trail from these trucks for 200 miles away. To think that this guy pulled out in front of this and was killed was beyond absurd, absolutely beyond absurd. So then they said, no, he died in a car crash on the way back to town, and that he died in the ambulance on the way to the hospital. But the belief was that he was going to make some major disclosure about his discovery that he had his own observatory down there, that he was going to make some kind of an announcement. And I had mentioned at one time that it may have been related to Hale Bopp, which had already been discovered. But also then something else might have been, you know, something in that southern sky that he had visibility. The next day, his observatory burns to the ground with all of his information in it. Gee, boys and girls, would that sound like something a little bit odd? And so anyway, back to John Nash. His John Nash wife, really it's his assistant who has been with him his whole life to try and help him, but they considered him his wife. But she dies in this auto accident with him. The story is that they're thrown from the automobile. It's a taxi that they're going to the airport or something, completely thrown out of this as this taxi is trying to pass another car, and die. Now, you know, when you try and silence somebody, most of the time you have to silence their wife. Let's look at Paul Wellstone, that his wife and daughter, two people that could have won the election if they would have lived, are on that plane with him. Who's there shaking Paul Wellstone's hand in the morning, 4 o'clock in the morning, as he's leaving this little South St. Paul airport in a two-engine plane? Ted Kennedy! Shaking his hand and making sure the daughter and the wife are on that plane with him. Gee, Ted, isn't he the same guy that made sure that John Kennedy Jr.'s plane was completely destroyed and nobody could ever investigate, and then made sure that the bodies were cremated so there was never any investigation of the John Kennedy Jr. plane crash that killed his wife? And she was pregnant. Oh, boy. I'll tell you something, boys and girls, grandmas and grandpas. This world is getting to be a strange place. But back to John Nash. He is the one guy on this planet that if he turned around and said James McCanney's prime number work is monumental and that it is significant and that it is probably one of the top mathematical solutions to occur in the last 2,500 years. Can you imagine if John Nash said that publicly? What would happen to Jim McCanney and all his name and everything that has happened regarding the trying to trash my name every place on the Internet? By the way, a listener wrote in and said there's I believe it's done by Google, it's called Wayback, and what it does is track all the activity on my website going back, you know, 10 years or more, or anybody's website. Mine has been completely erased from my website. So the entire history of my webpage archiving in these public archives has been completely erased. Isn't that interesting? But at any rate, back to John Nash, I know for a fact that John Nash is very interested in my work on prime numbers, and that he was in communication, let's put it that way. He was the instrumental, pivotal person in the world that if he made a statement regarding my prime number work, the mathematical world would crescendo around this. And that's what should have happened. But remember that the problem with my prime number work is that, number one, it broke the RSA codes, thus my follow-up book called Breaking RSA Codes for Fun and Profit. But it also removed the mystery of prime numbers. And remember, the demonic world controllers, the bankers, the masons, the ones that designed the U.S. dollar, if you look at the design of the U.S. dollar, the prime number 13 is all over it. to relate the number 13 to many other prime numbers and give it significance as a building block of with a lot of organization would destroy the mystical symbolism of the number 13, because it's a prime number, but it's a very essential prime number in the building blocks of the number system. And so, I mean, all of these different factors regarding the prime numbers, if John Nash would have stood up and said something, just like Gene Schumacher was about to stand up and say something about Planet X, it would have carried a tremendous amount of weight with the scientific community, in the case of John Nash, with the mathematical community. Remember that John Nash wrote the foreword for a book called The Riemann Hypothesis. There's a book called Prime Obsession by John Derbyshire, a tremendous mathematician. But the Nobel Prize winner in economics was John Nash. Now, John Nash was a mathematician, but his Nobel Prize in economics was for mathematical constructs that were used in mathematics and in all kinds of other mathematics. But my point is, in fact, regarding the Riemann hypothesis, there would not even be a Riemann hypothesis if my work had predated Riemann's work in the 1800s. The importance put on Riemann's work was they were still trying to look for patterns in the prime numbers. And of course, the Riemann hypothesis, one of the great unsolved mathematical problems. But it's really unrelated, and the people who understand this, including John Nash, including John Derbyshire, realize that even if you solve the intricacies of the Riemann hypothesis, it still would not shed light on the prime numbers, the way that it would not give basic understanding to the prime numbers. And so, literally, the work that I did regarding clarifying the prime number works, the prime numbers in my work, Calculate Primes, and that's available for the general public, the textbook on my website plus 3-hour DVD lecture, is so important to the history of mathematics. But remember, it broke the RSA codes. Also, it would have put my name at the top of the charts, and that's something that they couldn't do either. So they now are fumbling around with this absolutely ridiculous mathematical analysis, which they know, the mathematical analysis people know, that they cannot solve the understanding of prime numbers by using mathematical analysis, which use broad paintstroke generalizations around limits, etc., on certain boundary conditions regarding the prime numbers, but it doesn't give you understanding, predictability, etc. And that's what my work does. It shows you how to directly calculate the prime numbers when you use the generator function in my prime number work. Within 100 iterations of using the generator function, which you take you start with 0 and 1, you put it in the generator function, it generates a small group of prime numbers. You take that group of prime numbers, you put it in the generator function, it generates another larger group of prime numbers. And within 100 iterations of this, you have identified over 98% of all prime numbers from 0 to infinity. It's an extremely powerful mathematical formulation. But they can't let this out into the public domain because the government, the NSA, is still using RSA codes and forcing this garbage encryption technology onto the public. It's embedded into Windows. It's embedded into all kinds of secure computing, which allows the NSA to go in and snoop on everything that's going on. There are companies which are still selling this broken technology to the public, and it allows the NSA and other snooping organizations to go in and look into your computer at any time, look at all of your secure transactions online. All of this is being recorded. Why? Because the RSA codes are still being used for encryption and secure computing and for secure transmission of data. So at any rate, it's a huge topic. So let's go back to John Nash. When he died this past week, was he about to go public on a statement regarding prime numbers? Because that's a topic that he understood integrally, something that he knew very well, and he also held that position. Let's look at another guy that died. I've talked about this in the past, and a lot of people think I was crazy when I first started talking about this. In fact, let me go back 25 years when I first started hammering on NASA and saying, hey, these guys are a bunch of lying, thieving crooks. And everybody was like, how can you say anything about NASA? They are golden. Everything they do is correct. They're such, 100% right on. Well, now, the term never a straight answer, which I coined, is common knowledge. And nobody believes anything they say anymore. But it was 25 years ago when I started it, I was branded as some kind of lunatic. Well, not anymore. But let's talk about a guy named John Denver. He glided in his airplane that he died in San Diego Harbor. He glided that airplane, that very same long, easy Burt Rutan design. He glided that plane 40 miles into the Denver airport one time. He got in a lot of trouble for it, but the plane was capable of gliding for 40 miles without a motor into the Denver airport and landed unassisted without a motor. On the day in San Diego Harbor, he couldn't glide across San Diego Harbor. He did a nosedive, and when he hit the water, the engine, which is in the back, killed him, of course, when he hit the water. There was no way to escape. Burt Rutan made the comment that that plane could not possibly have done what it did that day. Obviously, somebody fixed John Denver's airplane. Why would they want to kill John Denver? Well, he was about to go into outer space with the Russian space program, become the first civilian in space, and his goal was to write a song inviting everybody to go into space. That was his final songs were about, they referenced the moon, mountains on the moon, and, referencing the gloriousness of being in outer space. And he had already conquered flying. And what he was branded as an alcoholic, as a nutcase alcoholic. That was the smear campaign that followed that. Anyway, I don't want to spend a lot of time on this, but this situation with John Nash, I don't believe it for one minute. I think something else very much was going on. How many taxi accidents do you find where the people are completely thrown out of the car and killed? Absolutely beyond absurd. I don't believe it for one second. A quick note on the shootings that are going on around the country. Cop kills black guy. Something is going on here, and I don't know who's staging these, but these are just like the we've had all over the country staged shootings, bombings, etc., by so-called crazy people. Now we have cops shooting black people. The cities are going crazy. The number of murders in Baltimore off the charts. Now we have Cleveland going ballistic. Get ready for a summer like we've never seen before. The tremendous weather in Texas and et cetera. I just wanted to mention also regarding weather, India, 48 degrees centigrade, unbelievably off the chart temperatures in India, killing, well, they say 1,000 people, which is a small number in India. They are used to the heat, but still it's stressing the world food supply. And so here's where we're going. California is not going to be able to provide the United States with 40% of its vegetables and fruit anymore. You have a serious situation. You have probably 30% of the world, of the United States population, living in California. It's if California were a country, it would be the fifth largest GPA country in the world. This is California. Unbelievable. Just going back to these are staged shootings, and I can't explain exactly how they're happening, but this country of the United States is about to explode and go ballistic as we head into summer. Just a quick note, liquid fluoride thorium reactors. something that started years and years, decades ago, actually after World War II, and congressional influence forced the uranium-based reactors. Why? Because they're breeder reactors. They breeded the plutonium that was used in bombs. That's why they wanted that vein of electricity, tremendously dangerous electricity, with the tremendously dangerous waste products. With the liquid fluoride thorium reactors, it's very safe. I mean, you could put it in your garage or in the basement of your house. It doesn't have a meltdown property. It's much more available than uranium, hundreds and hundreds of times more available, cheaper. Everything about this technology is better. And so at any rate, I see where there's been international meetings as, attended by hundreds of scientists. But what's tragic is the vast majority of so-called nuclear experts don't even know about this. And it's so typical of universities. I want to slam universities as hard as I can. I've taught in them, and I see the unbelievable garbage that they're teaching. People, in the case of nuclear technology, they don't even know about these technologies. They're not taught. And, of course, when they get their Ph.D., they think they're the smartest guy on the planet. Piled higher and deeper is what Ph.D. means to me. That's a term, by the way, I first heard from a woman named Marie Jones when I was at Cornell back in 1979. She was typing my books and papers, etc., that were being published. She was Carl Sagan's secretary, and she was a poor woman. She lived in a trailer house out in the country, tremendous secretary, but she and the other secretaries had an attitude. They called the PhDs there the piled higher and deeper. That's the first time I heard that. I hope Marie is still alive out there. She was just a wonderful woman, and that's back when you had to type and correct things. So if there was a mistake on a page that was going for publication, she had to type it all over again, and we corrected, she was just wonderful, worked with me. She knew that I was struggling to get these papers out, and she was the person who typed my papers that actually were being published in the Netherlands at the time. But regarding the liquid fluoride thorium reactors, it's something that should have been done decades ago, but remember that the real technology for energy independence is not more nuclear. The formula for energy independence is my wing generator work. Just a quick note, dealing with dysfunctional people. Now, it's something that we have to do in our daily lives all the time, and I've made an estimate. This is just in our daily lives, dealing with dysfunctional people. Probably a good 90% of our time is dealing with dysfunctional people, dysfunctional social structures, and certainly dysfunctional governmental structures. And so look at the amount of time, and I want everybody to personally do this. You probably have people in your family, relatives. And when I say relatives, I bet everybody's looking and rolling their eyes back and thinking of the dysfunctional people that affect their lives, relatives, etc. But I don't want to start any family feuds here. But dealing with science and scientific dysfunctionality, it's just unbelievable today. The struggles that the human race is going through, and Dr. Bill Deagle is great. I like when he makes comments. He's saying stupid science kills people, and it's really true. Bad science is very bad for you. And so when you go into a university, 95% of the science, this is, now I'm not talking about basic science, I'm not talking about physics 101 or chemistry 101 or thermodynamics or all the courses you take as an undergraduate, etc. I'm talking about things like plate tectonics, or the tremendously distorted history that's being taught to people. Anyway, I'm not going to go into detail. You could go through anything in space science, or about 80% of what they teach in astronomy, space science, or in fact earth geology, is just beyond credible belief. Anyway, but dealing with this is very difficult, and unfortunately I have to waste a lot of my time trying to manage this at re-educating the public. Just a quick comment. A listener sent this in regarding the red rain. The Japanese did a study of some of the red rains, and when I saw this thing, this article also, it said the India red rain resolved and solved, and that they think it's a bacteria that's in the rain. No. What they'd found was some bacteria that can be either green or red or other colors. Well, why don't we have green rain then? Why don't we have other colors of rain? There's something else going on here. And they're not being allowed to talk, obviously. But this study from Japan said there's a high concentration of uranium in the red rain. Now, when you have rain, you can very easily tell where that water came up, typically off the ocean. Most of our rainwater comes from evaporation from ocean water. And it's very typically very pure water. It's the process of evaporation leaves pretty much everything behind. But the fact that there is excessive amounts of uranium in the rain, I'm still kind of scratching my head on that one. I don't want to make any comments yet, but it's something very interesting. Changing subjects, I found it, I don't know if this is humorous or whatever, but they were on CNN this morning, I believe it was, they were talking about ISIS and about how they're winning and how, you know, various factors. They showed a picture of ISIS. Here they are in a U.S.-made Toyota diesel 4x4 pickup truck. Oh, gee, that might have something to do with it. They've got support from the good old U.S. of A. That's ISIS is clearly another CIA trumped up, you know, outfit, just like all of the other ones from Afghanistan, the on and on, the Osama bin Laden, Saddam Hussein, you know, the Shah of Iraq, of Iran. I mean, just on and on and on. These groups are just constructed by the CIA, and then 10 years later, we're dealing with some of those bad drug deals that went down. Just a quick note, there was an announcement. They say a new species of humanoid ancestor in the human tree back in Ethiopia. They just discovered this 22 miles from the place where they found Lucy in 1974. Lucy, of course, being that small hominid creature that they say is one of our ancestors. Well, I'm not sure about any of this, of course, being published in Nature magazine. The whole history of this search for man and man's ancestry is clouded with tremendous amount of misinformation. And as happened with archaeology, when things are found, they're classified by the people who have a vested interest in classifying them a certain way. So anyway, I'm not going to talk much more about that. Certainly a very iffy area of study is anthropology and the correct classification of the human species. In fact, tonight, my main science talk, I will be getting into this, how the human species changed just even a few thousand years ago with the event that's not even recognized in standard science, the Venus event or the Noah's Flood. Just a quick mention, Captain Kidd, they believe that some of his treasure they have discovered off Madagascar. Captain Kidd was a Scottish pirate, and I think he was captured and executed in around the year 1777, so about the time that the United States Republic was being formed. Scottish pirate Captain Kidd was meeting his demise, but he was actually a privateer from the English Navy, who was supposed to protect commercial vessels in the Caribbean. And he ended up over by Madagascar being one of the better known pirates. Now, here's a story that I have to talk about. I've talked about this before, but about 40 years ago, there was a signal that was received on the 1420 megahertz frequency. This is the water frequency that they think that aliens would be communicating on, because it's a common frequency, but they would be embedding unscientific or unnaturally occurring signals within this 1420 megahertz signal. And so they believe they had 40 years ago seen something. It only occurred one time. It's just a very strange juxtaposition of signals buried in this 1420 megahertz frequency and from a location in the constellation Sagittarius. Stephen Hawking, a long time ago, said, do not reply, because obviously you don't know who's out there listening. It'd be like, a guy drives up in a car on the street, and you're a little kid, and you go over, and he says, hey, little boy, you want some bubble gum? And you know, you go over walking over to the car. That's about the intelligence. And so now NASA is in the SETI idiots, are having a discussion as to whether they should return the signal. Well, clearly not a good idea. But these guys think they're being important people, and they should be returning signals to aliens, basically telling people that we're here. What a stupid idea, and I've talked about that before. So at any rate, on to tonight's main science topic, a new and interesting topic, how the human race changed after the last pole shift. Now, the pole shift obviously occurred during the Venus event, and that's something we can see in the Mayan structure, something I spent quite a bit of time doing in the jungles in Central America, actually with survey equipment, with the old-style transit survey equipment, which is a very interesting story just in itself, carrying that equipment down through the airports and into the jungle. Very interesting, because the case for the transit itself looks something akin to an atomic bomb. And so I'm coming back out of one of the southeast Mexican airports, and they're taking the equipment from a tourist, a family, a woman, a man, and a little boy and a girl, and the snorkels and their snorkel equipment and their suitcases. They're literally tearing the suitcases apart, I suppose looking for contraband. And here I am walking into the same line with the same customs officer getting ready to leave, and I'm carrying this case that looks something like an atomic bomb, and they never even looked in it. And I'm like, what's going on here? I thought that was just rather strange. But at any rate, here I am in Mexico surveying Chichen Itza, Uxmal, Tulum, these cities, and their structure is set up off of the grid lines. They're not set up on east, northeast, southwest. In fact, Chichen Itza is about 13.5 degrees off. And so I'm out in the jungle with an assistant looking for some marker pins that I said, now, you know, they had to set these up when they set up the primary directions of the city to do their celestial work. There had to be monuments way out in the jungle, far away from the city. So I'm tracking down the line, walking through the jungle outside of Chichen Itza. To the south, I found the marker I was looking for. And then to the west, which was where Shaq Mool is a character that looks like a 6-foot-tall Scandinavian with knee-high moccasins with fringes on it. And he's sitting there, a stone image of, he's called Shaq Mool, which is a French name given to this character, central to the city of Chichen Itza, with his offering plate in the middle of his lap and looking 90 degrees off to the west. And so as I went out and searched out to the west, I found the gate of the city of Chichen Itza, probably where the armies would come in after the defeat of their, you know, rivals in bringing back treasure and prisoners, etc. I found the gate of the city destroyed in the jungle, and it was there, all of the pieces, you could physically put it together, and of the form of Quetzalcoatl. So anyway, the point is that the Mayan cities were built upon the structure of the old Mayan cities of what were at the time, it must have been the Olmecs. The Olmecs are an ancient civilization that lived in the Yucatan region prior to the Mayans. The Mayans that we see today were structured, they believe, around 800 AD, were still in existence when the Spanish came, and were just about through their demise. There were, when I was in Mexico as a young guy, back in the early 1970s, kind of crawling around the jungles, etc., the Lacandon Indians were still there. And I went back into the jungle, back into the cenotes and areas like that, off of, for example, Tulum, and the Lacandon Indians were still there, living out in the jungle. These people were very tiny. They looked like little birds, probably no taller than about 3.5. Maybe the taller ones were 4 feet tall. This one woman, and now they didn't speak Spanish, and I didn't, you know, have any knowledge of their language, but we were able to communicate. And I went into just a side note, I went into one of their little huts on the ocean, and they had made some local pulque, which is a drink they make out of cactus. And they had it in a bottle. They gave me some. And I'm like, you know, you really want me to drink this? And when you shook the bottle, the sediment from the bottom, it was a kind of a brown color, certainly nothing clear, and this was basically homemade tequila. They wanted me to drink this, and down in the very bottom was the worm. And so they motioned what I was supposed to do. I'm supposed to pull the bottle up, and the worm would float down, kind of going back and forth, float down in this bottle, a reused bottle, that had like a wooden cork in it, and I was supposed to drink this swill until the worm got down, and when the worm went into my mouth, I could stop drinking, which was about half of the bottle's worth. And I'm like, well, I better do this, or they're going to be greatly offended. So I, you know, tipped the bottle up, and the worm, I'm watching the worm, and they're all watching the worm. And it finally goes into my mouth, and you would have thought I won the Super Bowl. There was screams and howls and laughter. It was like, yeah, you just won the Super Bowl in the last second with a touchdown pass. It was, you know, their way of welcoming you into their community. So anyway, with that, I was able to go and be around these people for a period of time. And I've told this story before on the air, but I was in the little, they had like a little store there where you could get fruit and coconuts and various other things local. The only product they had was condensed milk in a can. That was the only modern product that they had there. And so, of course, I bought a couple of those from them. But anyway, I'm standing, and it's about evening, and the sun is about going down. This is back in the jungle, maybe quite a few miles away from the little, from the ruins of Tulum, which is on the Caribbean coast, the Mayan ruins. And so this, I'm talking to this woman. Like I say, she's about 4 feet tall, if that. And above her, sitting on a perch, is a quetzal bird. And I'm looking at this bird, and it's a bird of paradise, very beautiful, and it's sitting on the perch. And just as the sun goes down, this bird spreads its wings and flies out over above me. And I'm looking at this bird right from here to there, almost arm's length, flying above me, and I look at the feather pattern on the underside of the bird, and it's in the shape of a comet. And this is why they called the comet Venus Quetzalcoatl, the plume serpent of the night sky, named after the quetzal bird, it's an old Mayan name or term, translated, of course, and written now in Spanish, the way the Spanish did. They took the terms, translated them into, you know, a form of letters that we use today. But the quetzal bird was a term that the ancient Mayan used, and that was why. Because it flew at night, it roosted during the day, it flew at night, and on the under form of its feathers when in flight, and then it had this long plumage tail like a bird of paradise. And, you know, it wasn't until years later, that was probably 1971, It wasn't until 1979 that I'm at Cornell University doing my work on comets, and I looked back and I said, you know, God put me there. I didn't know why I was in Mexico other than following my nose, looking for adventure, trying to understand archaeology, visiting some of the sites that were being dug up for the very first time back then. Okay, so why am I talking about the Mayans? Well, in little 3.5 foot tall people. This woman, by the way, that I was talking about, couldn't have weighed more than about, I would, maximum 40 pounds, I would estimate. And I believe that they're trying to preserve those people. The Mexican government has, one good thing about the Mexican government is they're very big on preserving archaeology. And because there's just such an amount of pilfering, a lot of these artifacts going on the world market for a tremendous amount of money. Even a little artifact would sell for thousands and thousands of dollars. But at any rate, look at the structure of these people. Now compare them to the 7-foot-tall African black man. Compare them to the Chinese, Oriental, Mongolian tribes that allegedly passed across the Bering Strait and populated the United, what we call the United States, Mexico, Central America, and beyond down to Peru. Well, we now know that there were entire cities along the Peruvian coast that were populated before the Egyptian pyramids were built. So the history that they want to preserve, in fact, I just saw an article, I'm not sure, if I think somebody sent this in, on what is known as the Kennewick Man. And this is a very controversial issue. There's actually a ruling in 2014, just last year, saying that they could not establish this skull and skeleton with what you would call Native Americans. And so the scientists have discovered was this was a Caucasian type of person in North America, in Oregon, in around the year 11,000 years ago, had a Clovis point lodged in its leg, in this person's leg. And so the Clovis point, of course, characteristic of about 11,000 years ago. And so they're saying, oh, well, this was just a guy that happened to be there, and, you know, all by himself. Well, excuse me, folks, you know, it's very clear that much of the history that we're being taught is totally incorrect. But the point is that for years and years, this skeleton, these remains were locked up because the U.S. government did not want to admit officially that there were any other natives here, contradicting that story, of course, that the Mongolian tribes came across looking for game or whatever when the Bering Strait was a land mass, then settled and populated the Western Hemisphere. Well, it doesn't make any sense at all. What makes sense is that there was a world population at one time covering the entire world, which was extremely diverse. And so what they want you to believe is that somehow in Mesopotamia, 7,000 years ago, the cradle of man existed, and that expanded out, crossed, and became the Mongolians, who later became, you know, all of the different tribes or whatever, variations of the human species down through Central and South America, including these 3.5 foot Mayans. When you go to the Mayan cities, when you go like Tulum, the doorways are only big enough for a very small person. Yet you have, at the same time, when Magellan crossed around the Tierra del Fuego, the reason Magellan named that Tierra del Fuego is because of the thousands of campfires you could see up in the mountains. And they actually picked up a giant, there's a giant femur that they brought back, which we believe is in the basement of the Vatican, hidden there so that nobody can see it. But the Magellan actually picked up in his records, they had a giant on their ship for a while who eventually died. Of course, he's not going to be able to survive very well, never been on a ship before. then the Magellan was trying to bring him back as an example of the people who are living in the Patagonia region of South America. That's down at the very tip. But known for its giants, and when they looked at the mastodons and the dinosaurs, the remains of those animals that go back far into history, they were also giant in that region also. So there's something very strange about Patagonia, possibly something in the dirt and the soil, who knows, but created these giant races, mastodons, humans, and going way back, the dinosaurs. So at any rate, now you're supposed to believe that within a 2,000-year period, with no stress, with nothing else to cause this diverse population, various populations of humans, humanoids, in the Central South American region, that the 3.5-foot Mayan ancestors of a very short time ago, just a couple thousand years ago, was the same ancestral clan that created the 10-12-foot giants in Patagonia. Boys and girls, grandmas and grandpas, talk about silly science, silly history. This is what's being taught in school today, all the way up to PhD level. So clearly there's something that happened. And so that's the point of my discussion tonight. What happened after that event, the Noah event? Let's go back in thousands of years. We are pretty sure that the Venus event, which was the Moses event, occurred around 1500 BC. That's when all the calendars changed. That's what Velikovsky's tremendous work pointed out. And, it seems like a viable time frame for that to happen. It just, it appears that possibly the Egyptian pyramids had been built prior to that with technology totally unknown at this time. Also on that same vein, I've seen things, and they're fairly convincing, that the Egyptian pyramids could have been built by hand, with just hand labor, with 10,000 slaves over a period of, a couple generations, that those potentially could have been built by hand. But I'm not saying they were, that you needed alien technology or whatever. But there's the story that we're being taught about the Egyptian pyramids clearly is not correct. There's a lot missing there. But let's go back in history, just looking at the Mayans. Back around 1500 BC, was when the original Olmec tribes or clans or populations, they were more than clans, they were probably hundreds of thousands, if not millions of people living in those areas. And when the Earthwide disaster occurred, that's when those places came tumbling down. So when they rebuilt those, the mathematics, the language, the culture, the myths, the religious structure based on Quetzalcoatl, the plumed serpent god of the night sky, whose heart eventually became the planet Venus, all of that culture translated into cultures that existed thousands of years later. And what Velikovsky was studying was calendars. What he was looking for was a baseline, some event that took place around the entire world that you could create a baseline of cultures thousands of years ago to bring all of those worldwide cultures together. But what he discovered was that there was a worldwide disaster. That's the Moses Venus event, as I talk about in my 2-CD set, The Physics of Ancient Celestial Disasters. But now we know for a fact that the Noah event, and this is what the Old Testament is all about. The Old Testament is nothing more than a history book of genealogy and of events of what they call creation, but these were celestial events. But the Noah event preceded the Moses event, so the Noah Great Flood, 40 days and 40 nights of torrential rain, which raised the ocean levels by 200 to 600 feet, we don't know exactly, but it's something like that, which would have covered the Bering Strait, which was a landmass. That's when the oceans rose and blocked any population from crossing there except in maybe small boats. But so there could have been transfer of population there. But the reality is that the Western Hemisphere was completely populated back then with races of people, and the little Mayans, the Olmecs or the pre-Mayans existed, the little people, and in South America, Patagonia, the giants. They did not evolve in a 2,000-year period with nothing to stress them or nothing to cause their evolution in such a diverse population, whereas in Africa you had the black populations, everything also from the very little, the pygmies, all the way up to the 7'7" black man who was, basically the precursor of the athletes in the United States today, as they were brought over in the slave trade and eventually populated the United States and, of course, provide us today with the greatest athletes because they just their natural abilities compared to us poor guys that descended from the Europeans. You know, they had actual good physical attributes also. But when it comes to football, et cetera, or other sports, basketball, I'm sorry, but I'm not going to make the New York Knicks basketball team at a little bit under 6 feet, and the slowest runner in my class. No way I'm going to end up being a great basketball star. It's just physically the way it is, and I can accept that. I'm much better at mathematics and physics, and I'll stick to doing that. But at any rate, so look at the world population. The populations first started exploring and going outwards, following those paths into different areas of the world, they found populations that were remnants of what had been there before. The Marco Polos, the Vasco de Gamas, etc., as they went out and found these various populations around the world, the Columbuses, etc., they were looking for something else and found the remnants of those ancient populations the world over. And so what were they finding? They were finding the remnants, and that's what Velikovsky discovered in the historical writings of all these civilizations, that the world, they all have the same story, that a big comet came through the solar system and devastated the world on various occasions. I'm about out of time here. I just want to remind you, go to the website, still tremendously low prices, although certainly nothing like the end of the world sale, but good prices still on the 10 packs of water filter elements, the GF filters that take out everything without any add-on filters, unique products like my pre-filter or the Recalendar Sunstar clock, my books, my book libraries, the CDs, DVDs, all of the water filter products. And I'm out of time. We'll talk to you next week. The webpage, jmccsci.com. That's JMCC, S as in Sam, C as in Charlie, I as in Indigo.com. This is Jim McCanny. This is my Science Hour. And as always, we are at the crossroads. Good night.